health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. Today's topic is one that I'm very pleased to get to spend some time talking about. And our person we get to talk to, very exciting. The topic relates to a part of being a health clinician that I have found particularly rewarding. I love what we call the subjective or the history. Taking a client's history is a clinical interaction that a practitioner tries to pull certain information out of a client to understand how they're feeling and what they're experiencing in their bodies. And then we pull out information that we feel might shed light on why they're feeling the way that they're feeling, that might be related to past events in their lives. And if you're listening as a person who's been a receiver of healthcare, and that is all of us, isn't it? I encourage you to listen too, as the all too common feeling of not having been heard in a healthcare scenario comes down often to the things that we're going to talk about today. And not feeling heard is important because it has implications for the outcome for you as a patient in the system and for you if you are a practitioner in the system. So think about a moment that you had an experience with a medical practitioner when you might have felt dismissed or hurried or disrespected or unheard. And how was that experience for you? And then think about when you've had a positive experience with a practitioner. Was one of those elements of that experience that you felt understood and like they heard you and had the situation in hand? I'm willing to believe that part of the example when you felt well looked after is that you did feel connected to. Part of that, whether you knew it or not, was related to how you were spoken to and how you were allowed to tell your story. It might surprise you if you're not in healthcare that taking a history from someone is a delicate skill. And we are taught as students of our professions, but like so many skills that you're taught, how well you do that particular skill varies from practitioner to practitioner. A good history taker is able to connect to a stranger in a very short period of time, ask them personal questions of an often intimate nature, and extract details that the client may not even realize are important or pertinent about situations that may have been painful or sensitive for the client, without inserting their own bias into the conversation. It's part of the clinical experience that I value because I was taught that if you ask the right questions and you listen, the patient will be able to tell you what is wrong. So this strong listening skill to hear what they say and also what they're not saying, that's the piece that is potentially challenging and very crucially important. And when you finally reach the professional setting, you also have to balance your desire to pull the story out of someone with the time that you've been allotted to take the history, complete an assessment of some kind, and very likely offer treatment. So when I think about this facet of practice that's so important to me, I thought of my colleague in physiotherapy, Lysanthia Taylor. I had the good fortune to meet Lysanthia in about 2016 or so. We were students together in a postgraduate course designed to deepen our skills and understanding of a method of approach to physiotherapy problems called Connect Therapy. And if you listen to our intro episode, you heard me refer to this. I learned that she'd been a clinic owner in her native Australia, a startup techie in the Silicon Valley, and was currently working as a physiotherapist in Shanghai. And after that, she went on to pursue a professional certification from Columbia University in something called narrative medicine. And after that, she combined the trifecta of the tech, the rehab, and the narrative medicine in a number of entrepreneurial initiatives, one called narrativerx.com, another called Pain Chats, where she is an author, and one more called Brain Changer, which we'll hear more about during the podcast. So, Lysanthia, I'm really thrilled that you've come on the pod today so I can ask you all the questions that I've had for the last several years of watching your life via Facebook. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, Jillian, it's such a joy to be here with you, and what a brilliant introduction. If I was a listener here, I'd be like, wow, I want to know about this. So I'm just overwhelmed. Thank you. And for the opportunity to reconnect, because it's been a while since we've been in the same place at the same time. This is amazing.
Agreed.
Well, Lysanthia, with the whirlwind of global locations that you have been during your career life, I wonder where in the world you are right now as we speak.
So that's a really good question. I'm coming from I'm coming to you from Lisbon in Portugal. So I haven't been home to Shanghai for 3 months because I left just as COVID-19 was emerging in China. And I'd only planned and packed my bags for a couple of weeks, which has turned into 3 months, which has turned into an unknown period of time, hopefully soon. Somewhere in that, I was meant to get married, which is why I'm in Portugal. My fiancé is Portuguese. But I'm very fortunate to be very safe in place where I am today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're safe. Well, let's back it up a bit. How did you get to China? Working and living in China seems like that could be probably something that we could have a whole other episode about. But how did you get there? What brought you to China?
Yeah, and I loved it in Jillian's introduction of sort of all of these different places that I've been and things that I've done. And as I was preparing for this podcast, trying to put together a timeline, and like we do with stories everywhere, it's like, well, how do we make sense of this story, and how do we put it together? And for me, as part of the story, China was actually fairly serendipitous. So I'd left Australia, I'd left the business that I ran, and I had kind of thrown my hands up in the air as a clinician and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be a clinician. I don't want to treat patients. I don't enjoy this. And getting to become a physical therapist was not something I really planned, in that it wasn't my first choice. It was just something I ended up doing, and I kept doing because that's what I'd studied and that's what I knew. And there were aspects of that interaction, of being a physio, of caring for people that I must enjoy because I'm still doing it. But I'd run away, and I'd run away to Silicon Valley, and I was working in tech, and I was never going to go back to healthcare until I finished in Silicon Valley and decided that that wasn't the place to be for me. And I thought I'd go back to Australia, which turned out to be much the same as when I left. And Australia is an amazing place, but it's a long way from everywhere. And it's so beautiful, so lovely. You get to go to the beach before you go to work, but it was not, I'd just come from, one of the busiest work environments in the world in California. So coming back to that was tough. So I had a friend that had a company in Shanghai, and he needed someone to keep him company while he started a new business. And I was a bit directionless, and it turned out to be something that was really very important for my life because it introduced me to one of the most dynamic and interesting cities and countries in the world. So I went there with no intention of going back to clinical work, but recognizing that in a city in Shanghai has 25 million people, and there's a small handful of Western physiotherapists. So for me, going back to the clinic gave me a whole different perspective on my work to be able to do it in a different place.
I'd like to come back to your first clinic before we dive into your work in China. And I understand that you were working as an equestrian physiotherapist. Can you tell us what that is?
Right. Yes. So I'd always ridden horses, and I'd always, when I went to PT school, I was looking at the things that we were being taught. A lot of it maybe around the sports science component of training, of exercise, of skill acquisition, and recognizing that that wasn't conversations we were having as, you know, with horse riders. So a horse rider is interesting because their position is their communication. If a rider doesn't have a symmetrical and well-organized sense of their body, their body is going to inadvertently influence a horse. And a lot of horses then end up having behavioral faults, behavioral problems. They can get their own injuries because a rider can't sit straight. So to me, that was something really interesting because it was complex. And you mentioned, you know, Connect Therapy earlier, and that was a lot of what brought me to Connect Therapy as well, was aiming for this perfection of a body that was completely straight, completely organized, completely able to respond to whatever task was required, and be able to sit in harmony and move with a great big, powerful and beautiful animal that really shouldn't tolerate having, you know, a human on its body, yet it does. And when it's happy and when it's balanced, right, we can dance, we can do beautiful things. So from a clinical perspective for me, it gave me a chance to, I could practice in the sunshine. I could be around horses. I could do all sorts of fun things. I was living in a rural area just outside of Sydney. But I recognize now that a part of that business as well was because I was looking for ways to be able to do this profession in a way that I didn't hate.
Had you ridden as a child? Did you ride horses growing up, or was this all brand new?
No, I did ride. I don't think I could have done it if I hadn't had a body knowledge, a felt sense of actually what it takes to sit there and look like you're doing nothing while a horse is prancing around and jumping around and going sideways and you know, jumping over jumps. I think you do need to know that is in no ways as easy as a skilled rider makes it look.
Right. And how about your tech startup? What was that about? And what was your role?
So my role, the company I worked for was owned by a friend of mine who I'd met many years ago, and he I'd watched him from afar, you know, do some really interesting projects and, you know, build. He was a software developer, and so I took an opportunity. I suppose I was doing this, you know, equestrian physiotherapist working with riders, but sort of thinking, well, this is not big enough for me. This is not going to get me where I want to go. Like, this is not enough. And from that point, a position came up with him. I'd kept in contact with him, and I was probably vastly overconfident in what I could do. took that big leap and sort of I put myself out there and I said, hey, I'll come to San Francisco. I'll come and do this work with you. So I've always been a keen writer. I knew enough about tech probably to be dangerous more than to be useful, but I was able to fit into an early stage team to push my comfort zones, push my boundaries in terms of what I thought I could achieve. Spent a fair bit of time working into overwhelm also when you go and move. You know, I'd never recommend it to that any sensible person, you know, did the things that I did, which was, you know, move countries and then move job roles. So kind of going into a, you know, a writing, marketing position, but also to completely swap industries. So I went from healthcare to software. And there's probably, if you're going to have to, you know, the two most, you know, domain specific industries for actually knowing what you're talking about, they're probably the two worst. Overwhelm was a thing. So having gone from that to then I'm just going to move to China, it wasn't actually that big a stretch when you think about it, because I'd pushed myself to that degree that a great big change, like going and moving to a country that you don't speak the language and you don't know the culture, I feel like I'd already done that because I'd gone to software. And then I didn't speak the language and I didn't know the culture of that world, but I'd survived that one so I could do it again.
So why not, right?
Why not? Exactly. Why not? The world asks a question of you. You get to say, well, what is my answer? My answer is usually yes. Yes and.
I love it.
So, Lysanthia, you are very open now about your discomfort with being a clinician. You've said it like twice already on this podcast. You confess it in every bio I read of you and due to all the places you are on the web, that was a number of times. When we first met in Vancouver, one day over lunch, you shared with me that you didn't like being a clinician, and I hadn't heard anyone say that before. Had you said it out loud before that point?
My family will tell you that I've said for most of my career, I hate being a physio. I don't want to do this. I don't like this. But what I think is curious in that is that I still kept doing it. I would have had plenty of opportunities to have not done it. And so when I say things like, I don't want to be a physiotherapist, I'm a reluctant clinician. That's my common one that I use now. I'm a reluctant clinician, which means that I've always questioned, you know, what is it that we're doing here? You know, and what are we hoping, what are we aiming to achieve? What are my expectations versus the person that comes to see me? And am I really helpful? So I never drank the Kool-Aid of being a physio. And again, maybe that also comes back to kind of falling into physio school rather than it really being something that I was massively interested in. I enjoyed the subject matter. I was really fortunate in my final year of physio school to do a clinical practice module at a multidisciplinary pain clinic. And that's probably been the most impactful part of my clinical work has been the understanding. When you understand what we do wrong with the way we talk about pain, and that there's a whole lot of science that is really quite difficult to apply to standard clinical practice in the ways that we do.
Lysanthia, I'm curious about how you see protocols fitting into this. I'm not a physio, but this is something I run into in my work all the time with movement and exercise science around fitness and movement with various pathologies. So there's the research, and there's the science and the stats and the data to show that X, Y, or Z protocol is appropriate for X, Y, or Z condition or client presentation. But sometimes the client's story will take you in an entirely different direction, or even tells you pretty clearly that this particular protocol won't be appropriate for a given client. So how do you square the story and the patient experience with the professional pressures to do things in a very specific way? Because, I mean, story can really change the context.
So that is an amazing, amazing question. What I love there is that recognition that there is a conflict often between science and story, and that science has its own kind of privilege. Because as you say, with those protocols, they're coming back to that, you know, that evidence base of research and again, this idea of certainty that if you do this protocol, you will be better at the end. And that's kind of what we have to sell to patients, to say that if you do the things I tell you, if you comply, if you adhere, you know, there's just that's such aggressive language even. You know, if you adhere and comply to these things that we've set out, you'll get better. But what about those people that don't? Because, you know, as clinicians, you know, Jillian and I know that you can apply those protocols and people don't get better. There's this complexity around, you know, the human experience. And when we realize there's all, you know, these interdependent protective systems, the ways our immune system is influenced by thoughts and beliefs and by, you know, context and environment, and you know, our immune system is going to affect healing. So, you know, if we're working on a tendinopathy type condition that might have more of an immune component in healing, if there's all this other stuff going on, like we can't ignore that, we have to look at, well, what is the meaning here? So if we bring it back to your question, so of you know, what, how would we approach this? You know, I'd say that, you know, story should come first. And the reason I would say that is that the story is going to set up the way that we personalize that protocol for someone. You know, this idea of the cookie cutter, you know, recipe book of, if we just do these five steps, you know, everyone will get better. If that happened in that way, we wouldn't have the great amount of you know, disability and particularly persisting pain, I think, that we have in the world. So I would, you know, in that situation, like, you, the opposite is also true. You know, it's not, we're not listening to story to live there. You know, we're not going to get bogged down in that place. I mean, a story is a testament. A story is for someone is to recognize what they've lived through, what they've been through, what got them to be here. Who are they as a person? What matters to them? And to be able to recognize those things, that then we can work out where does the loading, where does the loading happen? You know, where does the physiological change happen in a context that's meaningful to that person? How do we get them to load in a way that is, you know, safe and healthy for them, not just from the body side, but from them as a, you know, as a whole person?
Lovely. Yep. Let's keep talking about that. But okay, so in the end, you didn't abandon your rehab roots at all, actually, but you dove deeper into parts of those roots that continue to expand, like pain science and narrative medicine and tech and entrepreneurship. And frankly, Cynthia, you've been really busy.
What is narrative medicine?
Narrative medicine is a branch of medical humanities. So it's an interdisciplinary approach that I think can be best described as helping and teaching the skills of listening for health professionals, but doing it using art, literature, poetry. So rather than communications training, which or even motivational interviewing, what we're doing here is kind of taking it back to the nuts and bolts of how do stories work, why are stories important, what does a good, you know, what does a well-formed story look like, and how does that inform the way that we might interact with the interrupted and hard to hear stories that we're going to get in the clinic. And to me, that ability to deal with difficult stories is a fundamental skill that we have to have. In my area of persisting pain, all stories are difficult. There's not a story that's not difficult in someone's lived experience of that. But the way that we are as listeners, being able to sit with those stories, is going to determine the stories that we get told. Whether we get told, whether we're good enough listeners to be able to take in the enormity of someone's experience, and in such a way that is not judging them, is not looking to fix or to change that person's story. And that's really difficult as a health professional, because as a health professional, it's what we get paid to do. We get paid to fix things. So being able to be receptive to a story takes some training. And that's where narrative medicine, in the way that I've learned it and the way that I teach it, is that training ground for being a good listener.
And so how does one train to improve their listening skills and train in narrative medicine?
Yeah. So narrative medicine, as the way that I learned it at Columbia, we do it in a workshop setting. And we do it with a text that the teacher selects. So whether that is a piece of prose, a poem, an artwork. I just finished teaching a workshop this afternoon. In fact, we did it on Zoom. And we studied an artwork. And we simply get people to spend some time with that text, with that artwork, and come to look at it with, you know, slow eyes and in almost a meditative way, to let that artwork, do some work on you. Unlike the way that most of us go to the art gallery and we whiz around and we try to see, you know, everything on every level, but to realize that each and every artwork, you know, is a singular human output of emotion and of experience. So in a workshop setting, we would, as a group, look at a text or an artwork. We would, as teachers, we choose some stimulus questions that we would get people thinking about certain themes. But usually we're not steering them towards any particular understanding of a text. What we're doing is giving them a chance to hone their sense of perception, of seeing, of recognizing the components by which meaning is told in any kind of text. If we're studying poetry, we're going to look at what words are used, what rhythm is used, what rhyme is used, how is it structured, who is present, what voices are present, how do we come to feel the way that we feel when we read that poem, which all sounds pretty abstract and devoid of what is the real human experiences in the clinic. So once we've studied that text, we will do a timed writing exercise. So we write for 5 minutes and we apply that same idea of examining and looking and seeing what themes come up in that particular writing. And how do we use that text, you know, within that group to, you know, build connections between people, to help people to see and to realize that there's a whole lot more that goes on in a text than just the words that are said or the information that's disseminated. It's not just what is said, but how it's said, why it's said. Why does someone choose to put forward an idea with a certain metaphor? What does that metaphor mean? You know, all of these things that are quite literary in terms of the way that they work, but actually, I mean, what someone is learning in narrative medicine is these skills, we call it close reading. And when you're close reading, you are paying attention to all of the information that's there in that text, that, you know, every word is important. And when you can recognize what is an author has put there with every word that's important, what you start to recognize is when things are disrupted, when you get a story that makes no sense in the clinic, when you get people that leave out great big important details or their sense of timing is all disturbed and all over the place, the easy thing that we people often do is that they label that storyteller and they say, oh, that's a poor historian, you know, that person is unreliable. But when you actually have a sense of how stories work, those interrupted stories, that way the story is told yields a great deal of information about how that person is living and coping.
I have to say that as a former dancer and choreographer, hearing you speak about meaning in this way is quite thrilling, actually, sort of the combination of art and science. And I think that it's something that, for me, movement has always had meaning, obviously, when I was dancing. But listening to you speak to it in a clinical context is really quite wonderful.
And then there's me over here, the clinician, and It's interesting as you're talking about studying a piece of literature or a poem, and like I could understand how it would be super rewarding to sit with a group of people, very academic and very, maybe I'm thinking of literature, by the way. And then as you start to talk about translating that to a clinical relevance is where my heart rate speeds up. and my tension comes into my body and I'm not enjoying that nearly as much. I can see it would be really valuable. But that is where the rubber meets the road. That's the,
yeah.
I guess that's the thing that you're trying to teach the clinicians is here's all this richness. It's being given to you in that moment. If you can figure out how to appreciate the richness.
Oh, I love the way that you have a response to that. And I think that might be, but let's think about stress. Let's think about burnout. Let's think about the load that we have as clinicians. Each and every day we go in and one person after another is bringing us difficult stories and is bringing it to us to have those stories heard, but also to have us create a space in which some change can happen in those difficult stories. And that's even discounting the whole other side of the, you know, the physical examination of noticing movement. Is, you know, trying to make sense of this whole experience to be able to give someone the tools to shift along. So that that stress response that you have now to all the many things that are going on, to me, that's the day-to-day of clinical practice. And to me, that is why the, you know, I think of narrative medicine like football training. You know, a footballer is able to kick the goals under the highest pressure because they've done it time and time again with no pressure. Or they've done it in situations where they've had some control over it. And no one, you know, no one kicks grand final goals unless they've done that training. But instead, I think what we do with health professionals is we expect that without any training, you're going to be able to continue to perform and keep going and deal with all of these stresses and strains without reflection, without training, without a place to put our own lived experience of what it's like to be a clinician.
I have lots of thoughts. Okay, so is it taking a history? Is it more than taking a history that we're talking about here? Where does the rubber meet the road in the clinic if you are a practitioner of narrative medicine?
So I would think that we're not practitioners of narrative medicine. I would think a bit like when we talk about pain science, we don't talk about pain science-ing someone. No, we're not applying that science to them as an intervention. In a similar way, I would think of narrative medicine as being a core competency. It's a skill. It's a skill that sits there. In narrative medicine, we talk about what we're really building is what we call narrative competence. So I simplify that to being good with stories. And in the formal academic side of narrative medicine is the recognition that this competence with stories, this narrative competence, is the ability for us to build affiliation, to represent a patient in however they need to be represented. That all comes from that ability to hear a story. So that skill then is not, it's not reduced to taking a history. Although a history, to take a good clinical history is important. And it's important as much because it's rapport building as it is about getting all that salient information. So when we're listening in a way that we might be classed as being kind of this narrative competence way of listening, we're not actually even listening necessarily for the diagnostic key features. What we're listening for is for the entirety of the story. So in that, when we're listening for this entirety of the story, the whole story of someone's experience with you as a clinician starts from the minute that they even start to think that they're going to come in and see you. So it's, you know, so that this ability, Jillian, you and I know we, so many, our patients, our patients tell stories with their body as well. No, just like Sue just mentioned about dancing. When our patients tell stories with their body, now we have to be able to kind of to marry that up, perhaps, with the story that they tell about themselves. So how does someone then embody that story? I mean, that's actually moving a little bit further on from the more words-based aspects, and there's this literary aspect of narrative medicine, but moving it into how does someone live their story? And you know, we know, because we see the lived story when someone stands up to come with us into the room. How does someone convey all of the things that are going on with them? Will be in their body. And if we can attune to their body, that's our first way that we might realize that we need to listen for a bigger story than simply what are the diagnostic features that we can go and do something about.
It's the bigger story is always the richness in the room.
Yeah, sure is.
Absolutely. So this narrative medicine then is, it sounds like it's about supporting the clinician to make it easier for the clinician to bear the loads of being a clinician.
The highest goal, I think, of using a narrative medicine approach to training health professionals is what we're really trying to do is that holy grail of intersubjectivity, or of, you know, of being able to step down from our pedestal of being the expert. We can still be an expert in lots of things, but to be able to, you know, take down that power differential, take down that I'm the one that's going to tell you what to do, because that's extremely stressful for us in so many different ways. But if we can step down from that, because we can sit alongside someone and their story, and that person that we sit alongside actually feels like we really want to be there because we've heard everything, that lifts them up to, you know, to those other kind of holy grails of self-efficacy, of being a part of their own recovery. So I wouldn't say that narrative medicine is the job well done of narrative medicine is to be able to bring a clinician and a person that's come for help, to bring them closer together, to share the load of illness, to recognize the expertise of both of those people. And that only comes if you can share a deeper conversation. It comes if you can define meanings of things together, you know, rather than one person knowing all the answers and the other person being told what to do.
I love that you're speaking to this sort of more cooperative relationship. And it strikes me that our culture has created a very particular culture in healthcare, where as patients, we are going to see the expert. And to some degree, we're conditioned to give up on our own internal knowing because the expert has the answers. So what would you see as the patient's responsibility in showing up for this kind of a patient-clinician relationship? Or I mean, I think this could go much broader than just a clinical environment, but what do you see as the patient's responsibility in this?
I think the patient, I'm less inclined to look to the necessarily to look to the patient as having rather than expecting the patient to come in a certain way, because let's say if you're sick or if you're in pain or if you're anyone that's coming to ask for help, No, they are the person that needs to be cared for. And it's it's our job as health professionals. If we are the experts, then the first responsibility lies with us. And that responsibility then is to be able to hear that person's story, not necessarily live there. And I think we're kind of getting to, well, how do we get people to take responsibility for things? And of course, that's a really important part of any healthcare interaction, is that we can help someone, to do things differently. But I really think that my perspective is that the first responsibility lies with the person that has the most power. And in those relationships, by the way that our healthcare system runs, we have the power. Now, you might also, you might have patients or people that come in that have been so disenfranchised, so not listened to, that come in and they are angry. They've had such experiences that they feel completely hopeless, that they're absolutely not a part of their they're not even a part of their illness experience anymore. It's like it's happening to somebody else. It's in those situations, I think, that we as skilled listeners can realize, why does someone come to me in that way? Why is someone showing up in this position? Like, what is the full story here that means that someone is angry, that someone wants to blame me for what's going on? We're the ones getting paid. We're the ones that have that position of power. Again, doesn't mean that it's easy, and it doesn't mean that we should be walked all over. But we do have to realize that I think it's a real position of responsibility that we have.
Well, and maybe the clinician, as part of recognizing, with those listening skills, can sort of help the patient rediscover their own agency in this whole situation if it's been shut down.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So I think that's really important, is that, if someone comes into us and they are angry or they are shut down, can we have the capacity and the skills to recognize that's not personal, that's not about us? Well, it still might be unpleasant. Can we have a way to meet them there? Meet them where they're at with that, rather than expecting that patients are going to that we can have good patients, or we can have more we have patients that are more ready for change. Part of our job is to take them along on that journey, but we might get them at a place where they're not going to be able to really even have an awareness for themselves of what's behind that. No, it's getting to that backstory, getting to that point where someone can kind of, by being able to tell their story, by being able to be authentically listened to, they can start to make sense of why they're coming to different clinicians or different interactions, in a way that perhaps might get them labeled as being difficult. I don't believe that there are difficult patients. I believe there's lots of people that are hard to be with, but it's part and parcel of being a healthcare professional that we're going to meet people on the worst days of their lives. How do we build the skills to be able to be okay with them and be the person that they need on the worst days of their life and still have our own personal agency as clinicians, that those stories can come through us, but they don't become us, because that starts to be the burnout, the load, the feeling so bogged down in this practice, because you don't have the skills to actually, you don't have those football training skills around these really difficult stories to be able to let them happen and to let them go.
Lysanthia, as I hear you speak, it makes me think of the nature of Indigenous healthcare and justice systems, which are at their essence relational. I'm curious, in your travels around the world, experiencing different cultures, do you find that different cultures affect the narrative that you hear?
Oh, what a great question. I haven't experienced that for myself, but where I would take that more would be to the way that those, perhaps those indigenous stories enter into our general folklore, our way that the stories that have come from the past, how do they, you know, inform the society in which we live?
And then rather than, I think it goes back to what you've already talked about in terms of the power differential there, but it does seem like you're trying to encourage a bit of a breaking down of that top-down relationship to better understand each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're not taught how to step outside of the small box of us being experts. And living in that small box is a really tough job. So I think if we are competent in sharing stories, you know, and when someone shares a story with you, you're sort of beholden to share something of yourself with them. You know, it's a two-way street. So how can we not build affiliation between ourselves? And when you build affiliation, when you're in it together, then you're sharing the load. Then it's more likely that someone is going to be able to do the pretty tricky things that we ask them to do often in physical rehab, in movement science, in obesity management. Doesn't really matter where we encounter people, but because all of this comes down to behavior change and doing something different and challenge, it's got to start from this point of like, we are in it together.
I could talk all day about that, but I want to ask you, how do narrative medicine and pain science relate to one another? Because it seems that you've taken those two things and gone in a direction with them.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier about the science being privileged over stories. And I think in experiences like persisting pain, which can seem and does seem to many people that have it to be a really mysterious thing. And the social messages that we get about why pain might persist gives people the idea that they're always going to have this pain because they're horribly, terribly injured and their body is no longer any good. And all the metaphors that they use about being degenerated, being unable to live well, are not really borne out by the science. The science tells us that people can recover, and we know of people that do recover. But we have to be a little bit careful, I think, about some of the ways that science and pain, science, the science of pain, the way that the science of pain is used to explain someone's experience. So if we, perhaps if we're listening to someone's story and we hear them say something like, and I have my pain because my disc is degenerated, and the things that we commonly hear, and that my back's just stuffed, and I can't do anything with it. Unless you're able to, you know, sit with some uncertainty and not move immediately to correct that and to tell them that, well, lots of people can have degeneration without having any pain. I think we walk a really fine line in working with people in persisting pain of not seeking to tell them or to correct them on their experience. They are the experts in what they've lived through. The science of pain is really, really helpful in demystifying a lot of the pain science is really, really useful in demystifying why pain seems to come and go. why pain might be completely unpredictable, why pain is spreading, why do I have more pain now than I did a year ago, even though I've been doing less and less activity. Now, we can demystify all of those things, but what we can't do is use the science about pain to tell someone what they've lived through. No, and because if we do that, then I think we risk losing that person because we haven't listened to them. We've got to tell them and correct mm-hmm. them on what it is that they've felt. We're not creating definitions together. We're not really hearing their story. Again, we've come back to that idea of, well, I'm only listening because I'm going to tell you what you need to think or what you need to know. And I know that there's many people that don't do this. There's lots of really skilled clinicians that do a good job of explaining pain. I just like to caution that fine line between making sense versus explaining to someone why they might have done pain wrong. Because I've seen lots of clinicians do that too. And that's a really, really unhelpful thing for people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Lysanthia, what's your vision? Where are you going? Got all these initiatives.
That's a really good question again, Jillian. I've repeated that a few times. You might want to edit that out because that's my stock standard response to things.
We like hearing that we ask good questions.
Yes, it's okay. Good questions. Where am I going? When I think all the way back to my university days and having done, the bright light in all of my physio training was the pain science and the pain treatment. And over the course of the 15 years I've been a clinician, we've learned a lot more about the science and exponentially increased the amount of suffering for people globally with persisting pain, and whether that's through the treatment models.
Really?
Yeah. So we
you think so?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say we particularly, but in terms of global incidence of persisting pain, it's skyrocketed in the 15 years that I've been a clinician. So our global incidence is that 1 in 5 people have a persisting pain condition. It's the most common reason that people go to a general practitioner. But when we think about what kinds of treatment that is actually high value evidence-based care about that's related to teaching someone about pain, helping them to understand how that pain shows up in their life, what things can they actually do about it, understanding that a large proportion of persisting pain is a nervous system adaptation, and being able to give them access to quality care. They don't get that in a lot of the general medicine interactions that they might have. They get medication because, coming back to thinking about what kind of time does a general practitioner get for a person that has a complex and persisting condition that's not easily explained? And they might get 7 minutes. But most mm-hmm. people with these conditions are going to general medicine, and they're coming to us in PT as well, but they're going to places that the care that people for persisting pain, people with, the care that people with persisting pain get is non-standardized, and often it's of a low value. But we haven't really got that many examples of accessible high value care. And when I talk about high value, I'm talking about has an educational perspective, has a increasing self-efficacy, self-management perspective that also mm-hmm. doesn't cost $40,000 like the Mayo Clinic pain management courses. So that accessibility to care, it's really hard for anyone with persisting pain to access the kind of care that does put the power of that pain science back into their hands. So I guess my mission, because I've had such a kind of up and down and convoluted and sideways kind of professional career in all these different areas, I feel like my responsibility, because I've kind of done all that weird and wonderful stuff, is my responsibility because I've done all that weird and wonderful stuff is to be able to bring it together, to put it into some programs. And I'm working on a digital therapeutic program called Brain Changer. And Brain Changer is a platform of tools that help people not just to learn about pain, but to practice the kinds of behavior that we know move people towards recovery and living well again.
How will you change their behavior? Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah.
With the app. I'm really curious.
Yeah. So what the way that we work with Brain Changer is that we have a digital platform, and also the person is working with a coach, and the coach is a trained health professional like you and me. And we give them some training on top, including narrative medicine, of course, and also, you know, moving into a bit of acceptance and commitment therapy kind of work. But the main thing that we work with someone is, in terms of that behavior change, is giving them a daily way that they can self-assess what's going on in their life and how it's affecting their nervous system, because that, you know, and this is what we educate them around, the way that your nervous system is going to weigh the world and make sense of what's going on has a big bearing on how you feel. So in our app, we have it's a daily scoring system, and the scoring system really is just about finding, we call them halos, so good feelings, or good, you know, signals of some of that everything is safe and well versus zombies, which are things that are lurking around the corner telling you that you're not safe. So this is a learning process in itself, because when you start to ask someone, what are the things in your life that help you to feel safe and well and cared for and secure and all of these things, people that have had pain for any length of time draw a blank. They can't think of things. So then it becomes coaching around mindfulness, gratitude, recognition, or sending people out to remember the things they used to do. We call it halo hunting. Let's go halo hunting. Let's actually see what you might be able to add and change into your everyday life experience. And it's completely individual. It's up to what is that individual person, what matters to them? What do they value? You know, and at the same time, when we start getting someone to recognize there's all these zombies, there's all these things, and some of them are harder to bust up than others. But with all of these things, working with them step by step to start to unpack, you know, what's going on there. What kind of skills does someone need to build? What kinds of new information do they need? Do they need to go and see a different health professional that can help them in a different way? But being able to day by day have them collecting their own data about their lived experience, to be able to work with a coach to help them through that, makes a big difference.
And this is available for anyone anywhere in the world?
So Brain Changer is a 100% digital program. We are based out of Australia, but we can deliver services all over the world, and we do at the moment. I have patients that I'm working with across lots of continents. So if you head to brainchanger.io, you'll find our referral form. You can contact us through there.
Cynthia, one more question for you. And we ask all of our guests to the show. In your lived experience, what is health?
In my lived experience, health is a sense of trust and safety. And whether that trust and safety is internal, a feeling like your body is a safe home, a safe place to be, a safe place to inhabit, or whether in your external world of being able to access the care that you need when you need it. Because illness and sickness is going to affect all of us. But the biggest definer of health for me is being able to access the things that can keep you safe, keep you well.
That's a specific definition. We haven't actually had it said that way.
There you go.
Lucynthia, it has been such a pleasure to speak to you today for such a deep dive into narrative medicine. Keep on asking those questions that will make medicine more ethical, more human, more compassionate. And we will continue to enjoy cyber following you wherever you go. And we'll look forward to catching up with you again soon. For everyone at home, you can find Lucynthia at lucynthia.com. All her links to brainchanger.io and her various social media can be found in our show notes. So thank you, Lucynthia.
Thank you so much for having me, Jillian and Sue. It's been such a pleasure.
That's all for today's small conversation. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We'll be here next time.
And we'll have the coffee on.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.